In client conversations this past week, we dealt with the deaths of children and the pain of those experiences. These women were looking for other viewpoints that they could consider that would help them heal their sense of loss, or at least mitigate it. I shared some experience with them, and this talk is about those viewpoints. When I was a child, my older sister, Daphne, used to answer the telephone before it rang, and she initiated conversations with the callers before they could introduce themselves. So at an early age, I and my siblings knew that there was so much more going on than could be seen with the physical eye. I had my first experience with death when I was about 5 years old. I had caught a box turtle and I made it my pet. I kept it in a cardboard box in my backyard, and I set it on top of a barrel to keep bad things from happening to it, as in dogs or cats from getting at it. That barrel was used to burn trash back in those days. One of my older sisters, Patty, burned trash one day, and after she set the trash on fire, she put the box back on top of the barrel, and my turtle was burned to death. When I discovered what happened, I was hurt to the very core of me. I had caused this turtle to suffer a horrible death, and I felt terrible about that, and terrible about myself. Consciously, I concluded that loving things, to include turtles, was a certain guarantee of terrible pain. I may have concluded subconsciously other things, to include that me getting my way was going to result in horrible suffering and pain and perhaps death for others. Shortly thereafter, I caught a field mouse and I put that mouse in a cardboard box and tried again to have a pet. This time the pet died, and I never knew the reason. I didn't know if it was something that I had done, something I had fed it, or if there was another reason. But I knew for sure that having things, living things, was going to result in pain for me about what I did, and suffering and death for them. The topic of conversation around my house sometimes included death. My mother was a registered nurse, and when I was a child, she worked as a private nurse on night duty from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. Sometimes she wouldn't work, and I would ask her why. She would tell me that the patients, sometimes they went home, having recovered from whatever procedures were performed on them, or the patient had died. To me, when patients died, that meant my mother would be home more. She would have more time for me and the rest of the family. The conversation of death came up when I was 16 again, when my mother told me that an adult friend of the family's was diagnosed with terminal cancer and was told to go home and settle his affair. Instead of embracing death as inevitable at that time, Al went home and lived another 23 years. He obviously took responsibility for when death was going to be appropriate for him. He didn't give his power of life and death over to that diagnosis. My father died in a freak automobile accident when I was 18 years old. About a month before he died, he bought a suit to be buried in. He must have had some sense of this impending event, even though the circumstances really were a combination of a freak accident at a very slow speed and a minor injury, the steering wheel hit him in the throat, or his throat hit the steering wheel, and the fractured larynx went undiagnosed by the doctors in the hospital, and he died from that minor injury. I was a freshman in college at that time, and not on speaking terms with my father. At that point in his life, he was a deeply troubled man, transmitting his troubles to my mother, my younger sister, and my younger brother. When I was called at college and told of his death, I laughed in relief. There was relief for him, there was relief for my mother and my sister and my brother, and there was relief for me, the relief of being freed from an untenable unimprovable situation. When I was first in the Army, the subject of death came up pretty frequently because Vietnam was still going on, and people like me in infantry training were pretty much destined for Vietnam. In the spring of my 23rd year, two of my friends, Sal and Kevin, and I went to a palm reader in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina one weekend. Sal pressed us into going, despite our resistance. That palm reader, one at a time, gave us information about our futures. She told Sal that he would go to Vietnam and be wounded, but the wound would be minor, and he would be okay. She told Kevin he would go to Vietnam, but he would not be wounded, serve out his full year, and he would be okay. She told me I would not go to Vietnam with Sal and Kevin. Her predictions turned out to be exactly correct. Sal was wounded in a firefight early on in his time in Vietnam. He was wounded in the hand, and he was discharged with a medical disability. Kevin was not wounded. He served his year in Vietnam, came back to the States, and was honorably discharged. I did not go to Vietnam. I went to Officers Candidate School in Georgia, became an officer, and spent the majority of my six-year Army career in Panama. In that 23rd year, my mother, my older sister Mary, and my younger sister Anne introduced me to automatic writing. We connected to a spirit guide, or a being, or an intelligence that identified himself as a spirit guide for my sister Mary, saying that they had lived together in France in 1507, and he had died, and now his role was to be a spirit guide, rather than be in physical form. We talked about life and death over those nights during the summer of that year, trying to grasp what happened when people died, when they lived, and when they were born, and all sorts of things. And Julian, that was the name this guide took, gave us responses to all of our questions, making it clear to us that there was so much more before and after physical life, that it required the reshaping of our opinions about what life is, about what death is, about what birth is. Years later, when I was about 47, I demonstrated automatic writing publicly in San Diego, where I had moved from Manhattan. I was a businessman, and this was really something of a coming out. And I had an opportunity to work with people who had all kinds of concerns, all kinds of interests, to include the resolution of tragic experiences in their lives. Related to death, these two came to mind. One evening in a library in Escondido, California, doing a public demonstration, a woman came in and wanted to participate in this open demonstration. She was trying to resolve, unbeknownst to us at that time, the pain that she had experienced 18 months earlier when her 16-year-old daughter had been killed in an automobile accident. She told us in the midst of this meeting that she cried every single day for 18 months, trying to understand the meaning of this. So as we did automatic writing, depending on who was asking the questions and who was responding, the handwriting would change. And it became very obvious to me immediately that this was masculine writing, not feminine writing. And I pointed that out, that it couldn't be her daughter. And she said it could be my daughter because my daughter was very masculine. And then the phraseology, the languaging that was used in the writing, were typical expressions used by her daughter. And her daughter said to her mother this: "I am perfectly fine. I am happy. I am healthy. Everything is great with me. You can stop worrying about me. But in regards to my death, let me explain something that you've forgotten, Mother. And that is, you and I had an agreement that I was going to give you a gift that would put you on the spiritual path. My death was that gift. Up until that point in our family, we had never spoken of God. We had never talked about things spiritual. We only talked about material objects. Swimming pools, clothing, cars, jewelry, electronics, all the material things, and never a single word about God. My death was going to be the gift that sent you on to a spiritual path, seeking to understand and to have a relationship with God. You had forgotten that we had that agreement, but I am telling you, that was our agreement, and everything is fine with me, and now everything is going to be fine with you. Everybody in that meeting had tears streaming down their face at this kind of information flowing to us and through us. And this woman who came in with a dark cloud, if I could have described her as gray or blue, that would have been an accurate statement. By the time that meeting was over, if I described her as pink and rosy, that would be true. She had lightened up tremendously with the understanding of her daughter's death, not being a loss, but being a gift. Sometime later, friends who were psychics asked us to accompany them to San Juan Capistrano to do automatic writing for a family there that had a retail store. They too had lost a 16-year-old daughter to an automobile accident. Her name was Tara. Just prior to Tara's death, she started to collect angels. And so the store that we were going to meet at was the family store called Tara's Angels, because after her death, the family established a store of all things angels. They sold pictures of angels, artifacts of angels, books on angels, and all things angels. We went there that day, the mother, father, and a younger daughter, their minister, 3 or 4 or 5 psychics, and we did automatic writing. And Tara came through using phraseology that her parents immediately identified as the way Tara talked and the attitude that Tara had. And she spoke of the gift of her death as being a direction giver to her family to bring into focus the power of angelic energy, and for her family to promote this idea through her store. She said, "I like what you're doing with my store." And her parents said, that's how she talked. That's how she talked. She took ownership of things. And it was this gift to her family of the power of death, life after death, death being just a change of state, that shifted the viewpoints of her parents, the younger surviving daughter, and the minister, and the other people around the table, for that matter. It wasn't a loss. It was a gain. It was a change of state. It was a gift. It was a blessing, not only to the family, but to all the people who received support, solace, consolation in the store, Tara's Angels. Sometime about then, I read a book by Betty Eady. Betty Eady wrote a book about her near-death experience, and the point I want to make about that is she was looking down with some spirit guide next to her, observing a street scene of a drunken bum being approached by a well-dressed man who donated money to him as he walked by. And Betty Eady making a comment about that bum being bad or negative or some other degrading remark, in the spirit guide questioning whether Betty saw the truth. And she said, "Certainly, yeah, it's obvious, you know, there's a good man walking by, well-kept, well-dressed, successful, and this bum on the street, he should do something with his life." And the spirit guide said, "I'm going to give you a fuller picture of what's happening here. These two individuals have an agreement. The bum has agreed to participate in this other person's life in this particular role, so his friend, the well-dressed man, can find his purpose in life. He is serving as a catalyst to that discovery. The well-dressed man is about to discover his purpose of helping derelicts, indigent people, the homeless, the addicted, the people that get discarded by society. The bum is his friend who agreed to take that role in order for him to become aware of his purpose. Of the two, the most noble of the two is the bum. What you're seeing as a negative, degraded, bad life is in fact a tremendous gift given by this noble person on behalf of his friend, the well-dressed person. You completely misunderstood it by judging by appearances. Sometimes when people approach the end of their life, you hear conversations about tiredness. Near the end of my mother's life, she talked about being tired. Part of that is a not wanting to physically play anymore, getting ready to understand that the physical vehicle is either no longer serving us and we want to change state, we want a different vehicle and this one no longer serves us, or in a more distorted way, that we don't have access to energy. If we think of the human body like a D battery that gets used up and then consequently has to be discarded, we are overlooking a fundamental concept related to life, and that is we're rechargeable. We're rechargeable, connecting to our source, the source of energy, that power that flows to us and through us. If we disconnect from that, then we think we're all by ourselves. We think we're all alone. We think we don't belong. We think we're not connected. And then we experience tiredness and anxiety and fear and disempowerment. But the reason we experience that is because we disconnected from the source of our power. I suggest that death is a change of state. Change of state. I like that phrase, change of state. I happen to be sitting at this moment. Sitting Tom exists, but in another moment, Sitting Tom is going to cease to exist. Sitting Tom no longer exists. Standing Tom was just born. That change of state from sitting to standing is not that dramatic for a person that's healthy. It's no big deal. We just make a decision to stand up, occupy this different state, and here we are. But Sitting Tom is gone. He is gone forever. He's gone forever. Now I can remember him. I can remember him. And what's interesting is I can create a different Sitting Tom if I'm willing to have Standing Tom disappear forever. This Standing Tom is going to sit and disappear. Sitting Tom, a new Sitting Tom, not the old one, because that old one stopped processing information when he ceased to exist. There's a new Sitting Tom that has occurred, that's been created, that has been born. There's been a death of a couple of states. There was a change of state. And here I am, a Sitting Tom, a different one, but pretty similar to a previous version. Changes of state can be viewed from a variety of emotional states. I talk in terms of the 10 emotional states that I find to be very convenient for looking at things. It's a made-up scale. The bottom one is shame, then apathy above that, grief above that, fear, then lust, then anger, then pride. And the top three rungs on this ladder, top three steps in this scale, are courageousness, acceptance, and peace. We can talk about change of state from any one of those. Change of state, to me, is almost simultaneously a death and a birth the end of one state and the beginning of another. And when we look at it like that, all of a sudden, we can shift our fears about it and recognize that, let me get a new point of view about it. Maybe change of state is really what it is. If I were talking about starting a new business, that is both a death and a birth. The death is of the former person who participated in the economy as perhaps an owner of a different business, as an employee, as a unemployed or underemployed. That person is about to die. And a new person, the new person about to be born, is a new participant in the economic system of this culture. I'll call him or her the business owner. And like any birth, there is a requirement to assemble images, to assemble information, to assemble ideas, to assemble resources, friends, materials, and so on, in order to be able to continue on this path that has been begun with the birth process. The death of that former person, a person who says, I'm an employee, I have to stop being an employee in order to be a business owner. I have to die as an employee. And for the person who says, that's really scary, and of course it is, it can be very scary, it is because we are giving up the familiar for the unknown. Birth is giving up the familiar for the unknown. Death can also be seen as giving up the familiar for the unknown. Both death can be an adventure and birth can be an adventure if we choose to see it. They're both changes of state. Giving up the familiar, that is, embracing this change of state, requires courage. It takes courage to take a step forward. It takes courage to embrace the unknown. I wonder if the scariest thing about birth is being exposed. Being exposed. I'm wondering if the Bible has information that points in this direction. I don't know if the first thing that Adam and Eve feared, as depicted in the Bible, was being exposed, or if there was something that preceded that. But that fear of being exposed is a very, very big deal. Because of the way we are trained religiously in this culture, fear of death is the fear of being exposed. We're told all of our sins, all of our wrongdoings, all of our errors of omission are all going to be exposed on Judgment Day. We are going to be seen for who we are. In parentheses, that's a scary thing. Close parentheses. And so we fear death because now the judgment, all of our truths about us are about to be exposed. That stuff is all made up, in my opinion. It's made up. It's designed to provoke fear and increase controllability. If we can heal our fear of exposure before change of state, before we die, or before we're born, we will spend more time expressing the energy that flows to us and through us. If death is scary because we have to let go of the familiar, we might be able to look around at our lives and recognize that if we have given solidity, if we've given physical substance to our lives by accumulating physical objects, of amassing material things, this object and that object and this material thing and that material thing, trying to give substance to our lives. If we've done that to create a sense of security, to prevent ourselves from being exposed, almost as if we're layering material things over this core of insecurity, this fear of our inherent nature, death will still be scary to us. I suggest that healing that fear that something is wrong with our inherent nature is the way to go. I think that's a marketed concept that something is wrong with us. That's marketed to us. The Tibetan Book of the Living and the Dead emphasizes the need to overcome the fear of dying so that we can invest our energies in living. Since physically, we are going to die, and frankly, we're dying every single moment. Millions of cells are dying moment by moment by moment, and millions more are being born moment by moment. And when that goes out of balance, more die than are born, that over time, the physical body will no longer serve as a vehicle, and the spirit will withdraw. We call that death, but we can say it's a spiritual birth. The spirit is born again outside of the physical vehicle. If we're afraid of death, a lot of our living will be devoted to fighting death or fleeing from death. And so, really, even though we think we're living, everything is being dictated by a fear of death. We're puppets on a string. I don't think death is the absence of life. I think death is the change of state. Changing state is growth. If we looked at a tree that had been cut down, we would look at the growth circles in a tree. Each one of those circles indicates the death of the previous state and birth of a new state. Changing state is an adventure. It's new, it's exciting, it's a miracle. If we can start looking at death as changes of state chosen by the participant, not controlled by us for somebody else, but in fact a decision that each one of us individually has, that we can make choices relative to death when we change state. And if we believe we don't have a choice over that, we leave it up to bacteria, cancer, parasites, accidents, fate, good luck, bad luck, medical care, medical malpractice, etc., etc. We give away our power to live by thinking death is outside of us. It's a change of state, and we can control that change of state. We have the right to do that. We have the power to do it. We have the responsibility to do it, just like we have the right and the responsibility to determine whether to go from the sitting position to the standing position at any one moment. With regard to death, I think we individually can choose when to change state. We can make that decision. This is one of the reasons we've established a website, livetobe120andhealthy.com, is because our reality, our belief, is that people choose to live, they choose to die. They choose all the individual changes of state in between those two activities, and those two activities are the two most significant changes of state in a physical form. We are always connected to the healing spirit. Always. Always. Changing state physically or emotionally or mentally does not change our spiritual state. We are always connected to our source. And when we recognize that persistent reality, that constant truth, this minor issue of death loses its control or its power to induce fear in us, and we see it as the doorway to another great adventure, just like birth is. And between those two events, we can choose our attitude, our emotional states regarding all the individual changes of state that can occur, leading us to greater levels of living and growth and expression of this healing spirit. I would like to end this service with a prayer. Father God, Mother God, Christ, the source and connection to all that is. The one state that doesn't change is our connection to you. our awareness of that state does change. And we ask for your help, and we thank you for your help of us appreciating it. We seek to know more. We seek to feel more. We seek to be aware of more of your healing spirit flowing to us and through us. And may the light of your love be demonstrated and shown by our physical actions, our feelings, our thoughts, and our ability to connect to other people, seeking connections with you. Thank you. It is done. Amen.